in several parts of the country. That's probably one of the more imminent ones. The cuts at DOJ for local law enforcement seem like they may happen, but there's a chance that some of that funding gets reinstated. The department said that they're still considering some of the grants. So there's a spectrum. Obviously, we know that with Medicaid, that's still up in the air, but it looks like the Republicans in Congress are going to be cutting Medicaid.
And you got a response from Robert Kennedy's office, of course, in charge of Health in America, saying they're going to put money into establishing MAHA, right, the Administration for Healthy America.
Right. They're going to consolidate all these children's programs at the Administration for Children and Families that had run child care and Head Start and the child support system. It's another big one that the federal government does. It makes sure that child support payments get to families. All of those are going to be reduced and consolidated into this other area.
Well, Eli Hager, we're going to have to leave it to folks reading your piece. Eli Hager is a ProPublica reporter. We'll link to his new piece, The Trump Administration's War on Children. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh for another edition of Democracy Now!
Named Joe.
We're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available on our website at kboo.fm. KBOO's Board of Directors meets on the fourth Monday of the month at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland and online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting virtually can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Portland residents say they're willing to make cuts to the police budget to address the city's shortfall. Forecasters say this year's wildfire season seems eerily similar to 2024, and a unique astronomical event, a celestial smiley face, can be seen in the early hours of tomorrow morning. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, April 24, 2025. I'm Eric Leuschner. Portland is facing a $93 million budget shortfall this year, and a new poll shows the police budget might be the most agreeable place to make cuts. The shortfall is in the city's general fund, which primarily goes towards police, fire, homeless services, and parks. DHM Research polled a representative sample of 600 Portlanders about possible cuts. They found that more than 8 in 10 respondents oppose cutting the fire department budget. Cutting parks maintenance was also unpopular. 7 in 10 Portlanders disapprove of that idea. Instead, cuts to the police budget were more broadly agreeable. 4 in 10 Portlanders say that's where spending should be trimmed back. That's not a majority, but it's the largest chunk of approval for cuts of any option. It differs by district, too. Voters on the West Side and in East Portland were less likely to approve of cuts to the police budget. Residents in Northeast and Inner Southeast were more likely to approve of cutting police spending. Housing and homeless services were the next most agreeable cut. Mayor Keith Wilson's budget comes out next week, and before this poll, it was expected that he would make major cuts to parks maintenance to help balance the budget. Now, with public opinion factored in, those possible parks cuts are likely very unpopular. The poll also asked about Councillor Steve Novick's proposal to increase a tax on retailers making over $1 billion by a third of a percent to support the general fund. It would generate some $60 million a year and avoid most of the cuts that the mayor and city council are looking at. 69% of voters surveyed supported that idea. Oregon state lawmakers are still at work on the state's comprehensive transportation package. supporters of a project to create a ferry on the Willamette River rallied today to push lawmakers to put funding towards their idea. KBOO reporter Kenny spoke with the founder of Friends of Frog Ferry to learn more.
Today, supporters of Frog Ferry are rallying for financial support at the Capitol in Salem. Frog Ferry is a nonprofit working for electric ferries from Vancouver, Washington to Oregon City. Today, I spoke with Frog Ferry's founder and president, Susan Bladholm. For folks who do not know, what is Frog Ferry?
So Frog Ferry is a nonprofit grassroots effort to put an electric passenger ferry on the Willamette River, actually proposed 9 stops from Vancouver, Washington, down to Oregon City. Residents of the Portland area will recognize like the word Boone's Ferry Road or Taylor's Ferry Road. You know, these are roads that used to match up to ferry landings. And there used to be a ferry that connected from Vancouver, Washington, up to the northern part of Portland, just crisscrossing the Columbia River. That was over 100 years ago, the same month that we opened the I-5 bridge, because we had this new thing called the automobile, was the same month that we shut down that ferry system.
And you mentioned that you are at the state capitol today, and what are you asking for at the state capitol?
So we have requests into state legislators. There is a 2025 transportation package being considered by our elected leaders. We have a request in for funding there. The total request we're asking for the state is $10 million. So we've got a request in there. And then we also have a capital construction request in as well. So right now we're pursuing the 2 different avenues of funding with the state with the hope that one of those will work out for us. We don't like to think of ourselves as disruptive, but it is in terms of kind of the status quo planning and saying we've got to innovate and grab on to this best practice for the future of our community.
With KBOO Evening News, I am Kenny.
Fire forecasters say the outlook for the 2025 wildfire season is, quote, eerily similar to last year. 2024 was a record-breaking year for wildfires in Oregon, burning 1.9 million acres and destroying some 200 homes. Fighting those fires cost over $350 million. Forecasters say that come July, eastern Oregon and almost all of Washington will be at, quote, above average risk for large, costly fires, end quote. State and federal fire officials say they're ready to work together this coming season, but a big question still remains. Will we have enough money to pay for fighting these fires? Oregon Governor Tina Kotek had to call a special legislative session to authorize last year's spending. Under the Trump administration, federal support seems shaky. Earlier this year, Trump held back federal funding for wildfire mitigation work that helps make wildfires less severe. The Forest Service is still reeling from 500 employees who took a resignation offer from the Trump administration earlier this year. Many of those workers had a hand in firefighting operations and management. Lawmakers in Oregon are still circulating different proposals for how to pay for the firefighting costs. Wildfires are getting more extreme and growing faster than they did in the past. It's increasingly important for residents of fire country to move fast. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Last July, when a wildfire was reported near Lyons, Colorado, Fire Chief Rob Stump and his crew rushed to the scene. They could see the fire was growing fast and heading toward town.
Inside of probably 90 seconds of having been on scene, we issued orders for evacuation.
Those orders helped protect people from what became known as the Stone Canyon Fire. Stumpf says it's increasingly important for response teams and residents to move quickly when a wildfire starts, because fires are getting more extreme and spreading faster.
We're seeing preliminary notifications followed by secondary, tertiary, and then final mandatory evacuations happen in the span of minutes.
And as development expands towards fire-prone forests, more homes are at risk. Stump says when he started fighting fires in Colorado about 14 years ago, evacuations were usually limited to a small number of people in remote areas.
now it's pretty common to evacuate entire subdivisions and entire towns for wildfire because of the rate of spread and the density of development.
So it's critical that people understand the seriousness of the threat and be prepared. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
A rare smiley face will light up the night sky tomorrow morning on April 25th at around 5:30 a.m. Venus, Saturn, and the Moon will align during a rare triple conjunction to resemble a smiley face when viewed from the Earth. You will be able to see the smiley face for about an hour near the eastern horizon before the sun begins to rise. According to Brenda Culbertson, NASA Solar System Ambassador, Venus will be the higher of the two eyes, while Saturn will be the lower, and the thin crescent moon grin will appear slightly lower and farther north. Unlike other regional sky events, such as a total eclipse, the upcoming triple conjunction should be visible to just about anyone in the world. If you miss out on the cosmic smiley, another celestial event will follow on May 5th. About 40 to 60 shooting stars are expected per hour during the peak of the Eta Aquarids meteor shower. Eta Aquarid meteors are known for their speed, traveling at 40 miles per second into Earth's atmosphere, and can leave glowing trains, which last several seconds to minutes. Amid market blowback, President Trump says China's tariffs will be likely cut. Border czar Tom Harmon alleges Kilmar Abrego Garcia received due process, and the administration takes a tough line on people without housing. With more on the story, it's Alex Gonzalez with 2025 Talks.
Welcome to 2025 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
We were losing $2 trillion a year on trade. Now we're going to be making money, a lot of money. Every country wants to partake, even countries that have ripped us off.
President Donald Trump says he's in trade talks with China and may cut their tariffs in half. The world's largest economies have hit each other with record import taxes, sending shockwaves through global stock markets. After cuts, the levies would still be high, but U.S. markets rose on the news. A new poll shows Trump's economic approval falling to its lowest level ever. On social media, Trump is criticizing Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky for refusing to cede Crimea to Russia in a peace deal. Trump posted that an agreement is close and said Zelensky should give in because he has, quote, no cards to play. Border czar Tom Homan says the man wrongfully deported to El Salvador, Kilmar Abrego Garcia, was granted due process.
We removed an MS-13 gang member, public safety threat, wife beater, designated terrorist from the United States. He's home. He's a citizen of El Salvador.
The Supreme Court has ordered the administration to facilitate Abrego Garcia's return. Orders from the federal judge overseeing the case have grown increasingly critical of White House delays and obfuscation. Democrats in Congress are warning that the Trump administration is defying legal rulings in violation of the Constitution. Dick Durbin of Illinois, the second-ranking Democrat in the Senate, won't seek a sixth term next year. In a video posted to social media, the 80-year-old Durbin said it's time to pass the torch. At least three House Democrats and the state's lieutenant governor are eyeing the seat. Two leading Colorado nonprofits are collecting handwritten letters from a wide range of people likely to suffer if Congress cuts funding for SNAP. Carmen Maradian with Hunger Free Colorado says lawmakers need to see the budget is not just an abstraction.
We're talking about the real-life effect of cuts on real people. And so we want to hear from Coloradans what impacts SNAP cuts would have on them and how SNAP has shaped their life.
Republicans have charged the agriculture committees to cut $250 billion from SNAP to pay for mass deportations and extending tax breaks. The Trump administration says it's changing the federal response to homelessness, vowing to force people into government camps and require mental health and addiction treatment under penalty of arrest. Donald Whitehead is executive director of the National Coalition for the Homeless and says that's expensive and won't work.
People do not actually react to treatment that's forced upon them versus given the option of going on their own. Criminalization is not a solution. It's not effective, and it only exacerbates the situation.
The president supports encampment sweeps, which Whitehead says create misery and distrust and disconnect people from services. I'm Alex Gonzalez for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for the Global Citizen International Digest with Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. Then we'll hear from Street Roots Editor-in-Chief Kay Rambo about the Spring Anthology Volume 1 issue of the paper. At 6 o'clock, it's Moccasin Tracks. Then at 7, Hard Knocks Radio. Tonight's weather is a high 78 degrees during the day and is expected to drop to 50 degrees by 9 p.m. Tomorrow's weather will reach 71 degrees and will drop to 50 by 11 p.m. Today in history, in 1953, Prime Minister Winston Churchill was knighted by Queen Elizabeth II for his leadership in World War II. The quote of the day is from English novelist Anthony Trollope, who said, quote, "The good and the bad mix themselves so thoroughly in our thoughts, even in our aspirations, that we must look for excellence rather in overcoming evil than in freeing ourselves from its influence." Earlier this month, scientists and indigenous experts gathered in Utqiagvik, Alaska, to exchange knowledge about sea ice. With that story and more, it's Brian Bull with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bull, sitting in for Antonia Gonzalez. The ocean off Utqiagvik is covered with ragged sea ice ridges in early April. Inupiaq whalers build trails across the blue and white terrain to access hunting sites along the lead edge. It's hard to imagine a better spot for studying sea ice, and that's why a group of indigenous knowledge holders and Western scientists gathered there earlier this month. The Alaska Desk Alona Nyden reports.
The Sikkimute Field School was a week-long event that brought 20 specialists to Utqiagvik. Some were scientists working with climate models or satellite data. Others were residents from various Arctic regions who have hands-on knowledge about when the ice is safe for travel. Erin Emily Thomas is a sea ice modeler. She says she was excited to observe the ice in person and learn from other experts.
Having everyone just sitting in the same room, exchanging the knowledge, figuring out where is the missing gap of information, what should we be looking at, what's the most critical thing to study next. I thought that was the most exciting.
Participants spend mornings in a classroom running models and looking at data. Afternoons were spent on actual ice. It's important work, particularly as winter sea ice in the Arctic was at record low this year. Thomas says that sea ice affects the whole climate system, which makes observing it now crucial.
Maybe in the near future, there will be very little sea ice to go out on. So I think it's really important to study this now while we have the chance.
Savik Richard Glenn is an Inupiaq hunter, geologist, and a former executive. He led some of the hands-on activities, including checking ice thickness, watching for changes, and looking at the way snow and ice interact.
The little pieces of evidence that give you an idea about safety, about how prone the ice might be to movement, either breaking off and floating away or ridging up and grounding itself into the seafloor and potentially changing.
Glenn said that participants asked local whaling captains for permission to use their ice trails and work to improve them.
We tried to behave as if we were neighbors with the folks who depend on the ice for subsistence.
Organizers say they hope the workshop inspires scientists and indigenous experts to continue to exchange their knowledge in the future. In Anchorage, I am Alona Nyden.
A new species of bacteria that conducts electricity has been found on the Oregon coast. Scientists have named it for the Native Americans who historically lived there. The bacteria was found in a mudflat in the Aquinnah Bay estuary and has been deemed Coyacanensis. The original people's descendants are now part of the Confederated Tribes of Tsleil-Waututh Indians, who helped the researchers come up with the name. Chang Lee was a postdoctoral researcher at Oregon State University during the research. The rod-shaped cells that make up this form of cable bacteria have filaments that have electrical conductivity that help optimize their metabolic processes in the muck.
The cable bacteria are able to oxidize sulfide and channeling the electrons along themselves, conducting like wires and then go to the surface of the sediment and reduce oxygen, kind of connecting the two parts together by using electrical currents. So that's why I think it's super cool, and then they're ecologically important to the environment.
Lee says it's important to honor the original inhabitants of the land where this bacteria was found.
So I think that history, it's really rich, and it should be preserved and telling people what had happened. And I think it's especially more important nowadays because we're facing some unforeseen drawbacks on diversity, equity, and inclusiveness.
The findings are published in the journal Applied and Environmental Microbiology. This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bull.
As a Florida State University student recounts last week's campus shooting, Florida's sixth mass shooting of the year, state lawmakers finalize a controversial bill to lower the gun purchasing age to 18. Tramell Gomes reports.
Florida State University students joined survivors of past shootings at the state capitol this week, demanding that Governor Ron DeSantis veto a bill that would lower the gun purchasing age to 18. The protest follows last week's shooting at FSU Student Union, the state's sixth mass shooting this year, according to the Gun Violence Archive. Cam Strickland was working on an engineering lab project when the alerts flashed across his phone. He spoke moments after the campus-wide lockdown was lifted. The shooting, which killed two and injured six, marked FSU's first on-campus gun violence incident since 2014. It occurred weeks after the Florida House passed a bill to lower the gun purchase age from 21 to 18. However, Senate leaders confirmed they had already decided, before the shooting, not to take up the bill this session, effectively stalling it. Democratic State Representative Christine Hunchofsky of Parkland helped craft mental health reforms after the 2018 massacre at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School. She says her focus now is on trauma response.
I think what's most important right now is that everybody gets the help and support they need. I have seen what happens in the aftermath of these traumatic situations, and unaddressed trauma is very detrimental to people.
The 2018 Parkland massacre left 17 dead and 17 wounded on Valentine's Day. It ranks among America's deadliest school shootings. The tragedy prompted then-Governor Rick Scott to sign a package of reforms, including raising Florida's minimum age for rifle purchases to 21, matching the federal standard already in place for handguns. The National Rifle Association quickly launched a constitutional challenge after the changes. This is Tramell Gomes for Florida News Connection.
Lawmakers in Iowa are considering a bill that would create a state board overseeing the clinical use of psilocybin, the psychoactive agent in so-called magic mushrooms. Used in a controlled medical setting, psychedelics have been proven effective in the treatment of PTSD and other mental and emotional conditions. Oregon voters passed Measure 109 in 2020, legalizing the use of psilocybin in therapeutic settings. Since late 2023, psilocybin clinics have been getting started across the state. KBOO reporter Dajon has more on the story.
The Iowa legislature is weighing a measure that would expand the use of psychedelic mushrooms to treat PTSD and other mental and emotional disorders. House File 978 has passed the House and awaits action in the Senate. Spirit Lake Republican Representative John Wills sponsored the measure and says House File 978 would create a board to oversee the use of psilocybin, including the one found in so-called magic mushrooms.
Right now, there is data and proof that shows 82% of the time a person with PTSD will have symptoms reduced and or completely cured with as little as one treatment of psilocybin in a controlled environment. And so that's the key. It has to be done in a controlled environment.
Wills say the setting is important because mental health professionals counsel patients through a past traumatic event during the experience and help them find a positive way to process it. Wills, a military veteran himself, says mental health professionals can use psilocybin to help address the high suicide rate of U.S. military vets who suffer from PTSD. But, he adds, using it in a controlled setting could benefit other people too.
Police officers, firemen, emergency room doctors, anybody that suffers trauma at some point and has PTSD or suffers PTSD symptoms, they are more likely to commit suicide.
Neighboring states, including Minnesota and Michigan, have decriminalized psilocybin possession in some cities, but it has not been fully legalized for therapeutic use. The National Institutes of Health has warned against unrealistic expectations given that psilocybin use is still only in clinical trials. For KBOO News and the Public News Service, I'm Dejan.
On the corner of Northeast Cooch and 6th Avenue in Portland, a new cafe devoted to one special beverage is opening its doors. KBOO reporter Lexis Ponce got a sneak peek inside Project Matcha before its official opening.
A new matcha shop is opening up in Portland on the Central East Side with an aesthetically pleasing look and vibe. I spoke with the co-founder of Project Matcha on opening dates, menu items, and what it's like opening a matcha shop.
I'm Perin Meng Vong. I am the co-founder of Project Matcha. We are a specialty matcha cafe specializing in all things matcha. So matcha drinks, products, at-home products as well.
What motivated you to open a matcha cafe?
Yeah, so matcha has always been a part of my life. I've drank it since high school. It's just always just been subconsciously there for me. Every time I go to a coffee shop, if I'm not feeling coffee, I'll definitely get like a matcha drink or something. But yeah, just in the area, there really isn't a matcha cafe or matcha bar specializing just in matcha alone. So, you know, we wanted to bring high quality matcha here to Portland, and I think this is a great city to do it in. So, yeah.
Why did you choose name?
Yeah, so Project Matcha, at its core, it means to build something meaningful. So obviously with this, it's with matcha. Just sounds like a really clean name, and it's also me and my co-founder's first big project, in quotes. But yeah, we just really, really like the name and like the simplicity of the name, and it really matches with our vibe and branding and interior designs.
And what makes your shop unique from other like matcha shops in the area?
Yeah, I think the ingredients that we use and obviously the matcha powder, we currently work with a private company based out of Los Angeles. So they have their own matcha farm. So it's probably the best matcha you can get on the market. And simultaneously, we also work with a family-owned matcha farm as well. So we'll be getting our own matcha in August, as right now it is new harvest season, so it's the first flush at the moment. But yeah, just from the interior design to how we market, how we brand, and also the matcha, the type of matcha we carry, we really focus on high quality ingredients, high quality products, and just quality overall in general. So
what inspired you to choose this particular location?
Yeah, this is like Central Burnside, so this was a pretty prime location. It was a coffee shop beforehand as well, so we didn't have to deal with electrical plumbing, which is really the main things when it comes to a build out, like a full build out. But we really like the location. It's a corner lot as well, a lot of natural light. It's a great area, great community as well. Everybody's so welcoming. But yeah, just this area I really had my eye on for quite some time. So to be here is really, really a blessing.
Will you have other options on the menu besides matcha?
Yeah, so we currently have an espresso machine right behind us. So we're gonna offer coffee. We might do some things. We do have like pastry bites, like an ube white chocolate cookie, a mango panna cotta. Those things aren't really matcha related, but yeah, we have coffee, some bites. We're gonna implement some other food items as well in the future. So yeah, look forward to that.
For the non-matcha lover, what would you recommend?
For the non-matcha lover, I see. I got two drinks in mind. So I think a classic matcha latte for sure, with just some simple syrup and your choice of milk. I think that's a good like introductory to matcha. And then also very popular one, but the strawberry matcha latte. I think that's also a very, very good introductory to someone who's new to matcha.
So you just had your soft opening. How did that go?
Yeah, our soft opening was really, really crazy. We were blown away by the support from everybody in the community. Like I mentioned, I was expecting maybe 50 to 60 people to turn up, and to see like hundreds of people come and line around the block, it was just a really surreal moment and surreal feeling, and it just shows that Portland is such an amazing community. You know, I've always heard that Portland is great, and to really see it like actually happen, it was just a surreal moment that I still haven't taken in. But yeah, the soft opening was crazy, and we really got to see like everybody.
Do you have a set date yet for the grand opening?
I think we're shooting for May 3rd. This week, we're gonna do another soft open to really train our employees and get the logistics of the things down in terms of bar flow and everything. But yeah, we're gonna aim for May 3rd, which is a Saturday, following Saturday after this week.
And what are you most looking forward to when the doors officially open?
Just looking forward to everybody coming out, showing support, just seeing everybody's faces here, familiar faces, new faces, just everybody enjoying matcha, coming together as a community. I think that's very important. You know, whether there's a line around the block or whether there's 10 people there, I'm just happy to be able to serve our community and serve great matcha to everybody here in Portland.
And what will your hours be looking like once you're officially open?
Yeah, most likely 11 to 7. Maybe on the weekdays it changes and weekends it changes. We might extend our hours on the weekends because the sun's out. But yeah, we're going to look to stick with 11 to 7 and then adjust from there and see how that goes.
Is there anything we didn't cover that you want to mention?
No, we're just, for everyone listening, we're just really thankful for the community. If you like matcha, you like coffee, please stop by. We're located at 555 Northeast Cooch Street. And yeah, that's pretty much it for me.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Yeah, that was great.
For KBOO News, this is Lexis Ponce.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, April 24, 2025. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Mel Gertov, Lexis Ponce, Kenny, and Dejon. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Alex Gonzalez, Brian Bull, Tramel Gomes, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220.